early this summer, an indie feature-length martial arts comedy will begin filming here in Kansas City. The director has been holding auditions here in the Metro, attracting a wide variety of talents, including a former hog calling queen, somebody named Fred the First Aid Fox, a woman who gave birth on a reality show, an actor with Tourette's, Shakespearean actors, rappers, construction workers, nurses, and florists. The whole gamut of what makes Kansas City pretty interesting. I'm Jabulani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll get a lesson on feature-length budgets. Plus, we learn about largely obscure 19th century African-American activists and civil rights organizations that created the groundwork for groups such as the NAACP. That's all ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Every social movement has its unsung heroes, behind-the-scenes workers and pivotal thinkers who make all the difference in the larger scheme of things. But it's rare in history that almost an entire phase is left out. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. The book An Army of Lions, The Civil Rights Struggle Before the NAACP, details the formation and actions of black leaders whose names may only be familiar to historians, people who fought for social justice before Jim Crow laws were even on the books and before the NAACP rose to prominence. Our guest is the author of that book, Sean Lee Alexander, a professor of African and African-American studies at KU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Professor Alexander, before we get into the book, tell us how it is that history leaves out certain people of overall discussions of certain periods.
Well, I think the biggest problem that we have is that we focus on a few individuals, the people that kind of oversee the area. And especially with the time period that I'm looking at, Du Bois becomes the central figure because he's the one that lives the longest. And he's one of those people who has writes volumes. And as he goes through time, he actually begins to rewrite the history and leave more and more people out. And his position becomes more and more central. So that's a perfect example of how most of the people are forgotten in this time period for their civil rights struggle, as Du Bois becomes the central figure for us and everyone else is obscured.
You're talking, of course, about W.E.B. Du Bois, of the era in which your book takes place, which is the post-Civil War era all the way up to the beginning of the 21st century. Where does the name Army of Lions come from?
Army of Lions comes from a quote by a man named T. Thomas Fortune, who's a journalist out of New York, runs the New York Age is the last name of his newspaper. It starts as the Globe and then becomes the Freeman and then ultimately the Age. At the late 19th, early 20th century, it's the most prominent black newspaper in the country. And he's considered actually one of the best journalists in the country. He's considered the dean of black journalism. And when he's creating civil rights organizations, which is the one that he creates first, is the Afro-American League, created in 1890, he begins to question why the African-American community is not coming to their support in mass. And the title is a little bit of his kind of pull at them when he said he questions whether or not the black community is an army of lions or an army of mice. And I take that title to basically argue that this is an army of lions, at least the cohort that create these civil rights organizations and push for civil rights and the end of racial violence of the late 19th, early 20th century.
Tell us about the environment post-Civil War, the Reconstruction era that is the backdrop of this book and sets up the foreground.
Sure. The backdrop is what we're taught in history classes in America is that the Reconstruction period is held in Washington, D.C., right? It's a fight between Congress and the president on whether or not we're going to have civil rights for blacks, whether we're not going to include them completely in the voting public, et cetera. What's really happening, though, is on the ground in the South when we have the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in 1866 and the reign of terror that they'd used throughout the South to basically bring back redemptive governments and white supremacy in the South. That what they do is they murder on the average of about 20,000 to 50,000 people, right? And it's that violence that allows that transition for white supremacy to rise back up in the country. And what happens then is that carries over into the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, on into the 20th century.
Which is a sort of dark age period in Black history in terms of delving down into the central figures and the pivotal events, the 1870s through 1890. You look at pre-NAACP groups such as the African American League, the Constitution League, the Committee of 12, and the Niagara Movement, which is up to this point credited as more of an immediate precursor to NAACP. But how do you fill in the gaps here between 1870 and the 1890s?
What I fill in the gaps with is an argument to take it away from W. Du Bois is seen as the central figure because he is the leader, one of the leaders of the Niagara Movement. And because he becomes one of the central people for the NAACP's creation in 1909, everyone sees that as the precursor to the NAACP. What I do is I walk us back and try to show that actually beginning in 1884, you have the Black community calling for a national civil rights organization, right? This is a very early period. It's much – Du Bois is not active at this time. He's actually a teenager in Massachusetts, writing, ironically, for T. Thomas Fortune's newspaper. But it's a period where T. Thomas Fortune and this other group of cohorts rise up and say that we need to demand our rights. And there's two events very quickly that spark them to do that. And one is the Supreme Court makes a decision in 1883 that says that it's okay to discriminate and segregate the Black population, right? In 1875, we had a law passed called the Civil Rights Act of 1875 that said that was not okay, that you could not segregate people in places of public and private accommodation. In 1883, the Supreme Court comes back and says, no, that's actually unconstitutional. It violates the Constitution, and we can segregate, right? That's an important distinction because that's 1883, not 1896, because we always want to jump to 1896 with Plessy versus Ferguson and name that as the origins of segregation, but we see it actually beginning back here.
But that was the judicial turning point.
It's the judicial turning point, exactly.
Where it was decided that it would be the law of the land. Segregation would be the law of the land.
Well, 1896 with Plessy, what it does is actually confirms that the 1883 decision is okay, right? So the law of the land is actually set.
It holds it up.
It holds it up. It continues to set that precedent. The other event that happens in 1883 is there's a brutal riot in Danville, Virginia, where a group of people, a white community, basically goes into the Black community and attacks it and tells them not to come to the polls the next day. And that if they do, they will kill them. And some African Americans that do try to go to the polls, they do shoot them and prevent others from coming to the polls by terrorization. And by doing this, they disenfranchise that Black population. And what Fortune does is he looks at these two events as examples of that the Black community now has to stand up and fight for their rights.
And tell us one of the more distinguishing and interesting characteristics of T. Thomas Fortune, one of the more prominent people who plays a part in your book. He wasn't an, according to Hoyle, African-American.
No, he's not at all, actually. He is a son of a man named Emanuel Fortune. And Emanuel Fortune is a son of an Irishman and a Spanish-American woman, is how he puts it. But he actually means Seminole. But his father was his grandfather, T. Thomas Fortune, Emanuel Fortune's father, was a slaveholder, and he held Emanuel and his children in slavery. Then when his Emanuel was marries, he marries a woman named Sarah, and Sarah is also of Spanish Indian descent, meaning Seminole, in his words. So Fortune actually is a mixture of Irish and Seminole, basically, in his creation.
But born free.
No, he's not. He is born.
He's, born,
he's born into slavery in 1856, and experiences a brief time in slavery, and then grows up in Florida, is where he is, and then they gain their freedom, and then his father becomes a politician in Florida, and what Fortune does is he actually experiences the terrorization that his father experiences during Reconstruction politics, and that terrorization really forms his political stance that we need to defend ourselves.
That's what stokes that fire. How did the nature of leadership change after the Plessy versus Ferguson ruling in 1896, bringing us forward to the 20th century? How did it change, and how did these groups affect that change?
Sure. What happens is by having the ruling in 1883 and then 1896, you have now a law that you can try to go back at and challenge in litigation. And what these civil rights organizations do at the beginning is they form test cases throughout the country to challenge these civil rights legislation on the local level, the state level, and the national level. And that brings the individuals together to challenge precedent and try to set a new precedent, right? And what that really becomes for civil rights organizations and the black leadership, that becomes the focus for the 20th century, right? We're celebrating, you know, we just celebrated a couple of years ago the anniversary of the NAACP. And the NAACP's basic foundation is the same foundation that these guys are setting up in the late 19th century, that we're going to uphold demand that the country upholds the 14th and 15th Amendment and end all racial violence, right? In its nutshell, that's what the NAACP does.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR and streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Sean Lee Alexander, a professor of African and African-American Studies at KU. He's the author of An Army of Lions, The Civil Rights Struggle Before the NAACP. Professor Alexander will be speaking tonight at 6 p.m. at the Central Branch of the KC Public Library. Tell us about an organization closer to home, the African-American Council in Kansas. How did that come about? It's one of the organizations as a precursor to the NAACP that's mentioned in your book.
Yes, the Afro-American Council is an outgrowth of the Afro-American League. It runs together, really, is what it does. The Afro-American League dies off on the national level by 1893, and there are branches of the Afro-American League in Kansas. It stays on the local level for the next 5 years, and in 1898 it rises up as the Afro-American Council, same organization. They just decided to change their name for a different thing. What happens in Kansas is there's small local branches in the first couple of years of the organization, but they really begin to grow in 1900 and 1901, and they begin to come together because of an event that happens in Leavenworth, Kansas. In Leavenworth, Kansas, there is a lynching of a man named Fred Alexander. He is murdered on January 15th, 1901. If you know Leavenworth, the downtown area, the ravine right behind the downtown is where he is lynched. He is murdered. He's murdered because he's accused of attacking a woman named Eva Roth. And more importantly, a few months earlier, there was a woman named Pearl Forbes who was murdered. And he's accused of both of those crimes. There's no evidence that he is the man that actually attacked either one of these individuals. What they hold it on is that he likes to whistle, right? And that Eva Ross says the man who attacked her was whistling right before she attacked him. And everyone says, well, Fred Alexander likes to whistle, so clearly it's this man. And they take him and they burn his body. They first torture him, mutilate him, and then they burn him at the stake. What happens is they actually are given access to him. A mob is given access to him by the local sheriff, Sheriff Everhardy. And Sheriff Everhardy then goes into hiding, is a little afraid. And the black community rises up behind this lynching and begins to call for the arrest of the perpetrators of the crime.
The real perpetrators of the crime.
And they argue that the governor should give them a reward for the apprehension of the individual, et cetera. And they do get Governor Stanley to agree to give them $500 if they can arrest the man. Ultimately, they come back and tell them that they want to arrest the sheriff because of derelict of duty. And very quickly, the governor says, oh, no, there's absolutely no way you're going to arrest the sheriff. You know, that's not what I've agreed to. But the interesting thing is by going at the public official rather than an individual, it's the same tactic that the NAACP will later use in the 1920s by using this attack of derelict of duty rather than trying to solve who in the mob is the actual person who could allow this crime to happen, right? That they're going to say that the person who let them out of jail is the person that we should get to. The other interesting thing with the Alexander lynching for us in this area, in the Kansas area and the Missouri area, of course, is we have this long history of a so-called border war, right? And the state of Kansas is actually horrified by this lynching. And they
still to this day.
Still to this day. And the legislature actually makes a statement that they're contemplating whether or not to kick Leavenworth County out of the state. And the interesting thing is Platte County very quickly rises up and says, we'll take them. Right? So you have this, you know, this continuation of the border war throughout this event as well. So
tell us about how these groups formed their platforms and premises. Was it based on a reactionary approach to lynchings or to specific incidents like we saw in Plessy or specific incidents we saw in Leavenworth, Kansas? Or was it more of a grassroots platform, or both?
It's both. It depends on where you are and whether it's the local level or the national level. It's very similar, again, to the structure of the NAACP, right? The NAACP will always take a case on a local level and get involved in it, even if it won't set precedent. But the national office may not get involved unless it's going to set a precedent or challenge a national standard, right? And the same thing is going to happen with these organizations, that they will attack local events and local platforms, have local agendas. But what they want to do on the national scale is they want to attack those Supreme Court rulings of 1883 and 1896 in particular, also 1898, which is the Williams versus Mississippi case, which approves disfranchisement of black voters in reality of what it does. It says that these new laws that's coming up in the South are not really based on race, and so therefore it's okay to discriminate. Based on state rights. Or that you can say someone's paying a poll tax and a white individual may not have the money to pay a poll tax, so it's not really based on race, right, is what they do. So they want to attack those on the national level. But on the local level, they want to go at events that are happening, whether that's discrimination in insurance rates, whether that's discrimination at local establishments, or actual acts of violence, right?
One thing that you do touch on is the fragmentation of some of these groups in terms of their aims. Talk a little bit about that in that era.
Sure. The fragmentation is an interesting thing, because I think that's really what we boil down to at times, is that why are we celebrating the NAACP's centennial and not the centennial of the Afro-American League or the Afro-American Council?
Which sounds more like baseball, the Afro-American League, than a civil rights organization.
Absolutely.
Because you haven't heard of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's actually, it's funny that you mention that, because there are people that don't know that when the organization is first founded, they said, what does it mean? Right? And other supporters of the league said, we understand that with the Afro-American League, it's for the rights of the Afro-American. It's alpha and omega, right, is what they push. But what happens is you have a number of individuals that really become fragmented more, not necessarily on what they believe should be done, but on the belief of who should be leading,
right,
and
right,
who should be the voice to be heard. And I don't want to, it's always tough for me to come back, but it's. I always argue that it's some levels, it's fragmentation occurs because of egos, right? It's egos being hurt. It's egos being said, I'm the one that you should be listening to, rather than this person. There's backbiting, etc. As one newspaper out of Cleveland, the Cleveland Gazette, it's a newspaper, a wonderful paper at the turn of the century, run by a guy named Harry Smith. And Harry Smith calls the Afro-American Council's meeting in Louisville, Kentucky in 1903 an event of cerebral elephantitis.
Wow.
Which I think is a wonderful term, and it actually explains everything, that this is a group of people that are just bumping in heads, right? And they're fighting over something when they really all want the same thing.
Were there then two ideological schools that then broke off into W.E.B. Du Bois's integrationist school and Booker T. Washington's economic nationalism school?
There are two schools that break off of this, but the interesting thing about these early organizations, the Afro-American Council and the Afro-American League in particular, they try to bridge both schools. They can see that both schools are developing, and they try to control both or contain both within them. But what happens is, because of Booker T. Washington, this looming figure over the time period, this man who's seen as a person who's controlling it, man who's accommodating the Southern way of life, he becomes so fragmented. He causes the fragmentation more than anything, his mere presence, right? And because of that, these people want to run away from him and create something else. The interesting thing, of course, is that Booker T. Washington is not the real problem. He's actually funding these court cases more than anyone else is actually doing in the organization, probably except for a person like T. Thomas Fortune. And more importantly, he's pushing the case. In 1905, the year the Niagara Movement is formed, and the year that they form it, saying that we're going to get rid of that old conservative leadership, and they mean Booker T. Washington, in the state of Georgia eliminates the Negro militia. And Washington writes the council lawyer, a guy named J.D. Wetmore, and says to the effect of that this is against federal law, because you have eliminated the black wing of the National Guard. And this is against the federal regulation. You should take this to the courts, right? In the bottom, what he's saying is we need to keep our guns.
Right.
That this southern situation is so detrimental. If they eliminate the Negro militia, they can take our guns away, no different than they've done in the past. That's a very radical position and not something that Du Bois is actually believing he's saying.
Well, tell us about two pivotal groups as the 20th century comes to a head in your book, the Committee of 12 and the Niagara Movement. Tell us about those. Yeah.
The Niagara Movement is, as I said, this is a group formed by Du Bois, and it's a group that's formed in 1905. And it's a group that says that they're going to stand for radicalism and pushing for radical causes. But in reality, they do the exact same thing the Afro-American League had started to do and the council had been doing for almost a decade at that point. The Committee of 12 is an attempt by all these individuals to bring everyone under one umbrella. They can see the fragmentation happening. So what happens is a dual meeting is pulled together by Du Bois and Booker T. Washington at Carnegie Hall in New York. And they try to discuss what they're going to do. And what they ultimately do, and this is the thing that people miss, is they create a civil rights organization, which is called the Committee of 12. The difference of that organization is Washington is the head, right? And he is the leader of that organization. They also want to use more of propaganda or publications to educate the public. They will support civil rights legislation, but they want to educate. They believe that the education will change things. And Du Bois leaves that organization very quickly and then creates the Niagara Movement.
Which in turn created the framework for the NAACP, or is credited with.
Is credited with the creation of the NAACP, but the NAACP really is the Afro-American League platform.
How did all of these groups eventually merge into the NAACP, and how did the NAACP and Urban League gained such consolidated prominence and therefore the treasure of history, the loot, the spoils of evolution?
Right. The interesting thing is in 1908, there's letters being sent back and forth between Bishop Walters, who's the president of the Afro-American Council, and Du Bois calling for unification of all these organizations. Then we must unify. We must bring everything together. What happens then is in Springfield, Illinois, in 1908, there's a riot, and a man named William Wallings writes a letter saying, where is the old abolitionist group? We need to have a voice for the black community. That is the call that brings the NAACP together, the creation of the NAACP in 1909 with the Negro Conference, right? The individuals that answer that call, over 20 of them, there are 40 people that answer the call, over 20 of them, almost 30, are members of the Afro-American League, the Afro-American Council, the Niagara Movement, the Committee of 12, right? So this is the backbone of that organization that comes together. And what they're willing to do is set themselves, their organizations aside to create a new civil rights organization because they believe that will happen. And they really kind of suck it up in some ways that they, you know, when they're saying, where are the old abolitionist groups, they're certainly going, we're here. Where have you been? And we're willing to take that chance and create that organization. So it's a convergence of that time. But ironically, the black community was already calling for a unification. It just gets credited that it's Wallings and this white community that does create it.
Based on the stories we see in Army of Lions, how is the black leadership in this country now different and similar at the outset of the 21st century? When we look at the legacy of the NAACP and what formed it.
Sure, that's a great question. It's always tough to, you know, to get historians to talk about the present. So.
Right.
but I think what we do see is we still see a fragmentation within the black community and the leadership of the black community. I think, you know, recent events, of course, with, you know, what do we have? We have public intellectuals and we have political leaders. And do they merge? Not very often, right? You have, you know, Melissa Perry Harris and Cornel West arguing amongst themselves. Then you add Al Sharpton every once in a while. And then you have people like Alan West on the Republican side or someone like Cleaver on the Democratic side not meeting with this, right? And so we really have a fragmentation of what should be as a coalition doesn't really come together, right? And who is the leader of the black community? I think what it really shows us over and over again is the black community is not monolithic, nor should it be. Right. But we label them as black leaders and say that they should be the voice for the entire community. And then because of that, they clamor for who's going to have the voice, who's going to be the one that actually is listened to or speaks the loudest.
And as we see in Army of Lions, some of the same conditions are ripe there for fragmentation, unification, and change as they are now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What are some of the upcoming projects that you got going on?
I'm working on a book on the Ku Klux Klan hearings of the 1870s and 1870s. What happens, as I said before, that over 20,000 people are killed in the South between 1866 and 1872. Some people say that's a conservative estimate. I would say it's closer to 50. And what I'm doing is I'm creating a book that looks at the hearings. What the U.S. government does is they send people down to the South, congressmen down to the South, to interview people who have been who perpetuate the violence, as well as people victims of the violence. And I'm looking at those hearings and writing what I believe is the true story of Reconstruction. This Reconstruction story is not in the halls of Congress and the White House. It's actually on the ground, and how the violence intimidates Black voters. And that's the most immediate project that I'm working on.
So the struggle continues in research, both in unearthing the past and examining the present as well.
Absolutely.
Our guest is Sean Lee Alexander, professor of African and African-American studies at KU. He's the author of An Army of Lions, The Civil Rights Struggle Before the NAACP. Professor Alexander will be speaking tonight at 6 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Thank you for joining us on today's program.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll talk to a Kansas City, Kansas police officer and martial arts expert who is now trying his hand at comedic cinema. We'll see what hijinks ensue when we return.